There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So, Guy, Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Settler Control Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets.
You did. And in fact, that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So, join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon, and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever
Echoes,
heard, frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, the Settler Control Tour.
Hello, Guy.
Hello, Gary. How are you?
Oh, I missed you.
I know, same. It's been an age.
Mid-July, I think we last saw each other.
Yeah, but you've been everywhere, haven't you?
I went to Greece on holiday. I climbed a few mountains in the Lake District and I went to Iceland, which is an extraordinary place, for a few days. And we did a lot of... We like to get out and hike around.
No, I know. You're that dad. You are that dad, aren't you? Come on, everyone. Come on. It's not that cold.
Which is exactly how I feel about season 3. Which we're about to embark on.
Yes.
I can see the peak ahead of us.
Yeah. Well, hopefully there won't be too much rain. I know, clouds gathering.
It's going into our tour of America, which so we've got a couple of weeks where we're off on tour, I think in a week or so's time in the States for 6 weeks. And we will hopefully be bringing rock on tours to you from various cities in Canada and America.
Yeah. And hope, I mean, because obviously it'll be good for American artists because we'll have much less of a time difference to contend with.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you discover any new music this summer while I've been away?
No, I hate music. Not really. I've actually been listening to a lot of Mahler. Because at the end of the tour, I went straight back to Hungary and I was a judge on a sort of thing called Virtuosox, which is like an X factor for young classical music prodigies. And the English people on the panel were me and Harvey Goldsmith. And it just kind of got me thinking that sort of classical music has almost become like the underground. What we do is sort of the total mainstream as opposed to when we were kids. So I've been immersed in classical music more than anything. So
that's great. You know what I got into? Because my son listens to a lot of different music, my 18-year-old, who's going up to Edinburgh to do music for
That's
for
right,
four years
fantastic.
Now. I got into Black MIDI.
Oh, yeah. No, I listened to that on your recommendation. I mean, it's very big and very dramatic. I mean, it's great stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're only young and they're just doing the most complicated stuff. But the other thing that's really exciting that's going around is math rock. And there are few sort of bands that I'm going to delve into over the next few weeks in math rock.
Math rock, what is it? Is that like a sort of new prog thing? Where it's all
it is
of...
really, where they play in different time signatures and it's quite a thing. My son's
It should
into
be maths
math
rock. That's an American term, math.
Maths rock. It wouldn't be progs rock, though, would it? It wouldn't sound as good, would it?
No, yeah. But we don't say progs.
Yeah, that's true. Maths rock.
Maths rock.
Algebraic rock.
Yeah.
Oh, that's something completely different, isn't it?
Algebra would be quite a good soul singer.
Anyway, we've got Ian Brodie on.
We have, yes, fantastic. Ian, which is an extraordinary career he did that with, you know, people become artists and then they sort of drift off and become producers. Whereas he was an artist, became a producer, then went and become an artist and carried on producing. And he's, you know, an amazing character.
But what I'm interested in is because we haven't had, I don't think we've had anyone on from this era of the Liverpool scene.
No, this is something I really, really want to get into with him. That's actually the bit that really fascinates me. It's like that's mid-70s Liverpool. It's almost like sort of it's like a punk version of Paris in the 20s.
Yeah, and Eric's was the club, right?
Exactly. There's all these characters, but I want to save this.
We're saving it.
Save it.
In fact, I could see him coming through the door now, electronically speaking.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I've been sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
So great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah. To
get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Oh, thanks for coming on, Ian. We met many years ago, didn't we?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
On a holiday, a family holiday.
Like another lifetime ago.
Or was it LA or something like that?
It was in Los Angeles, and I remember our kids were in the pool.
That's right, yeah, yeah. They're giants now, aren't they, those kids, obviously.
Absolutely, yeah. Awesome.
And you came to one of my comedy shows once, I assume by mistake.
Very self-effacing, you know. How'd you go to a comedy thing by mistake?
No, I wrote that line for him anyway. He wouldn't dare have said it about himself.
Where are you, Ian?
I'm just in my house, actually, in West London.
All right, okay.
We us three have got something in common, other than being musicians and writers, obviously. But we've all written songs that have been sung on football terraces.
Oh, yes.
I had a very, very exciting summer because I'm an Arsenal fan. And we signed Zinchenko, the Ukrainian boy. And all over Twitter and Instagram, I'm seeing the crowd singing, Zinchenko, always believe in your soul. And my 13-year-old boy, who's an absolute Arsenal nut but has no interest in what I do musically, suddenly was as proud as punch about this particular thing.
And course, it's a lovely thing, isn't it, when people are singing a song.
It's the best. Yeah, it's the best. I co-wrote Vindaloo, which was wasn't Hot on Your Heels, but it was the other song at the Euro.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But you always want, because we had that terrible thing of the chorus of Vindaloo is just that little bit too long. So there's that fantastic thing, if you'd hear the fans would all start singing it and then they kind of get a bit lost and then they'd run out of steam and then they just go into My Darling Clementine.
but Guy, wasn't there, on the re-release of Three Lions, Ian, wasn't there, you two were in competition with each other for number one and number two? Who won?
They won, obviously. We were number two.
I knew that. I just wanted you to say
it. She's rubbing it in. It was a moment, actually, wasn't it? There was just this moment at that time where there was all these football records that were quite, there'd been, you know, decades of ones that were awful. And then all of a sudden, there was the Black Grape one, and it was like quite cool, really, because there were all these quite good ones.
Because I remember in 1971, when Arsenal were about to win the double, and Good Old Arsenal came out on the Pi label, and we lived in a council flat within a house. We had a floor of this house and we decorated the whole place. Our cousin who lived upstairs said, yeah, let's do it. We had banners everywhere. My brother and I put our speaker from the record player on the window ledge and played Good Old Arsenal endlessly.
And of course, nice one, Cyril.
Yes, do you know the first football record I had, which probably doesn't count in the same way. Like when I was little and Liverpool won the FA Cup for the first time and I couldn't go and my dad took my elder brother and I was, you know, I was devastated, but we won and he bought me an album called E.I. Adio. And it was, on one side, it was the commentary of the whole game. And the other side was just like football crowds singing songs, you know. So I actually used to listen to the commentary over and again.
Was it like one of those Top of the Pops records where they'd actually had someone go into the studio and recreate the commentary?
Yeah. No, I think it was actually...
Trevor Horn did it.
Commentary. Yeah. You've ruined my memory now. It probably was.
But listen, I'm interested in this little bit of social history. Because was the first Because no one, when you watch old footage of crowds from the 50s, they just rattle. So they don't sing. But then there is this footage of the cop singing, I think, She Loves You, or a Beatles song. And was that the first time anyone had ever sang on a football terrace?
I don't think it would have.
You'll Never Walk Alone.
Yeah, I think it was probably, I think it might have been the first time. I can't guarantee it, but I think the cops started singing songs of the day because it would, I mean, that would have been about the time when I first went to football, really. It was probably, you know, 64, 65, that kind of era. So my first memory is very much shock at seeing my dad and my uncle burst into song with You'll Never Walk. I've never seen them sing before. and I was like, whoa, you know, and then the cop singing all the songs they sung. So it was a very, and it was a midweek game. It was Liverpool Leeds, bright floodlights, you know, white, green of the pitch, red, and all these people singing. So I think the two things were fused in my head instantly, you know, and I loved the singing, really, and the game, obviously. But it was like, I think for me, that was just the two things at the same time, you know.
Well, and of course, the band that we're in, Sourceful of Secrets, because we play Fearless, which features the cop, which was then adopted
by the Justice Hillsborough thing, which is fantastic.
Which we're really proud of.
I remember as a kid hearing that, and yeah, it was such a strange thing because I was
especially
from
as Floyd are actually an Arsenal band.
Yeah, and I always remember hearing it and not thinking much of it because I was so used to it, and then later on thinking, yeah, why is that on that record?
Well, I think it's very Floydian, isn't it? Because it's in a different key and there's the dissonance that they like. Roger probably enjoyed the dissonance, didn't he?
Yeah, maybe there's an irony in there.
But you know, I mean, one, you know, what you described was fantastic because there wasn't, none of us went to church. Well, certainly I didn't. I don't know whether you came from that side of Liverpool. But it was the only place you'd see your dad being emotional. But also, it must have touched you musically. Is there a connection between how you want to write songs and what you did and listening to those songs on the football terrace?
Well, there's a definite connection between Three Lions and You'll Never Walk Alone. You know, because it's a song about the fans and Three Lions. And I think previous to that, and of course the FA really didn't like it because they didn't understand. It's like, well,
oh, that's interesting.
Where are the team and what, you know, so from day one, they really didn't get it and they just couldn't make that leap, really. You know, it's like, well, it's about the fans. It's not about the team, really, you know. And I think, you know, You'll Never Walk Alone is definitely, you know, about you know, walking through a storm and all that. It's about the fans and with the team, I suppose, but it's a similar kind of feeling.
Your songwriting is for a large part very, very joyful and very up, isn't it?
I try to be really positive so that nobody can see how negative I am, probably. Do you know what I mean? It's like at first you're sort of hiding stuff, aren't you? You know what I mean? When you first start songwriting. But then I felt like it's quite easy for me to write more, you know, in a less positive fashion. But I think probably where I came from as well at that time with Echo and the Bunnymen, all these things in Raincoats and Joy Division, and that was where I was coming from. I thought, well, I can't, you know, these bands are amazing. I'm going to try and do the opposite of that, really, you know.
I was trying to sort of pinpoint where the Lightning Seeds music lived and what it had influenced. And one of the tracks that I thought about it coming from was The Only Ones, Another Girl, Another Planet. Which, you know, it's got to be one of the most, I mean, I don't want to say, you know, the greatest pop record, one of the greatest pop records ever made with so much punk energy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Actually, we covered that on a B-side in the 90s. And should I shut the doors? A playground just started outside. Well, there's all these kids.
I
wondered if you had an active dungeon.
The prisoners are getting out. I can't. Is that okay? Do you think?
Why not? You know, he's going to shut the door. But I don't know what happened to The Only Ones because it was the only one, wasn't it? Really,
Peter Parrott.
Yeah, in the first group I was in, that was a band called Big in Japan.
Big in Japan.
Yeah, we did very little, really. We only did a few gigs. It was only a couple of months. But one of the things we did do was support The Only Ones. And I loved The Only Ones. I loved, they had this drummer who at the time seemed pretty old to me. Actually, he was probably about 22 or something. You know, he seemed like an old fella. And he'd been in this band called Spooky Tooth.
Oh, wow.
Who
I'd
vaguely seen album sleeves of. And, you know, and he was like proper drummer, you know. And
You did Spooky Tooth as a drum fill there.
I think because he made a big impression on me, that drummer, to be honest. I don't know why. I always used to watch the drummers, you know, when I was watching bands, because they seemed to drive the whole thing live and the beats. But and they had a fabulous guitar player. And actually, it was funny. And he was great with me, actually. And we supported him in Birkenhead or somewhere. And he was very, you know, complimentary about my guitar, you know, and sort of said to me, you should go to London, you know, you should go to that London down there and, you know, and all this, and kind of connected me up with a couple of people and stuff. So they kind of had a big impression on me, The Only Ones.
And then I think the place that the bands that have been influenced by you, the track that popped into my head, which came up quite a few years later, after Jollification, is The New Radicals. You know, you can't get what you give, you know. Which is,
yeah, he was a great songwriter, that guy.
Brilliant. I said, yeah, Todd Rundgren chords.
Yeah. Well, I used to love, you know, a couple of Todd Rundgren songs.
Yeah.
Saw the Light being the main.
But let's go back to, because Gary and I were talking about this before you came on, it was that whole Liverpool scene, you're in the beginning, which is, it was like when punk happened, it was like there'd been this whole world just waiting to coalesce. And kind of, you know, this incredible scene, the amount of people who came out, you know, everyone, you know, from your Roger Eagles and your Phil Drummonds and you and your, you know.
And then Pete Wiley, Julian Cope.
And it was like a sort of punk Paris in the 20s.
But Def School was also come up there.
Clive Langer and, you know.
Yeah, just slightly earlier. I think Def School was just slightly pre-punk. And then, yeah, there was all us kids who used to, I suppose, I always feel like, you know, a lot of misfits seem to gather in Matthew Street. And Matthew Street,
yeah, of course.
You know, Matthew Street was where the Cavern was, but that seemed, you know, another, even though by today's standards, probably only 7 or 8 years previous, or 10 years previous, but it felt a long time before. And it was a rundown area of the city. And I think my memory of first meeting all those kind of people was, you know, just as I left school, and for some reason I was wandering around on a rainy day, and I wandered into that part of town, which was pretty much, you know, old cobble streets and old warehouses that were empty. And I came across this building, and it said, "The Liverpool School of Music, Dream, Art and Pun." Carl Gustav Jung on the wall. I'm standing there thinking, that is weird, you know. And next to it, with these two giant metal containers, which are rusty, on waste ground. And I was like, what is this place? And this Irish guy was outside. He said, buddy, you come in and have a cup of tea. And I went, you know, I went in, and it was just, these guys had just opened this warehouse. I don't know for what reason, they just felt it would be a good idea. And in there, I kind of met, there was a troupe of actors up from London, and they were putting on a play called The Illuminatus, and I ended up in that play as a guitar player. And I met Bill Drummond, was the stage manager, Jane, who was in, and Roger Eagle was starting Eric's across the road, and Probe Records opened opposite, and the whole thing just suddenly very quickly came together.
But also you had, as a sort of cross-cultural thing, I don't know if this fell in the talk, sorry, because Bill used to work at the Everyman Theatre as well, didn't he?
Must have been his connection previously.
Because also, this was the time when the Everyman had that legendary company of Bill Nye and Julie Walters. And so it was like every base was covered up there.
And it must have been connected to that. That must have been why. Yeah, because I think Bill Nye was in the play, and he was put on by Ken Campbell and a lot of...
Oh, fantastic. So you were a seeker. That's what Ken Campbell used to call all of his audience, seekers. You were the seeker.
I was definitely seeking something, yeah. And it was, it was like a new world to me that I stepped into. And what was great was then on you know, I remember saying to this guy, Charlie, one of the guys down there, I said, what are those big metal things on the waste ground? And he said, oh, you know, he got this stuff up. And he opened them. And they were fridges with ice sculptures in. And it was like this mad little 20 yards of Liverpool in this most unlikely place that was just like,
wow,
you know, full of oddballs, really. And I loved it, you know. And I think that that was the start of my career in a way.
So, but every name we mention here is, you can Google it and you'll find out that, yeah, what greats they went on to. I mean, Bill Drummond was, I mean, KLF gave him, burnt £1 million, didn't he, as an art piece?
Allegedly.
Yeah, Jimmy, my mate. And they, yeah, and famously wrote a manual on how to have a number one record.
Yeah.
Which someone did, didn't they? Someone actually did it.
I think they did it. I think they,
I mean, someone
documented
the
making the record.
Yeah, no, but someone actually just got the book.
And did it again,
just by following the book.
But wow. you were in a band.
I must get that book.
But you were initially, because Bill Drummond went on to manage Echo and the Bunnymen, but you were in a band with
Julian Coe, yeah,
Bill originally, weren't you? You were. I mean, the Big in Japan band had Holly Johnson in, and
Holly Johnson, didn't he play bass or play guitar?
Bass.
Yeah, Holly was the bass player.
The bass player. Yeah.
Because you had Big in Japan had a kind of art school feel about them, and an art music feel about them. There was elements of sort of electronica coming in and Roxy, and, you know, I mean, obviously OMD and Andy McCluskey were around at the time as well. So there must have been that scene going on in Liverpool.
Yeah, I remember there was in a typical Liverpool story, which I think it's okay to tell. I remember the first electronic band, just previous, but friends of theirs, I think, was a band of OMD. It was a band called Dalek, I Love You. And I remember saying to the guy, I remember going to see them at Eric's on a Thursday night when no one was there. And I said, so what made you pick up synthesizers rather than guitars? And he said, a mate of ours said someone had basically stolen stuff from a music shop. And he bought it unseen, and when it arrived, it wasn't guitars, it was synthesizers. That was the start of the synth.
And thus the 80s were born. But what was Eric's like? Because it's an infamous place now. It was the CBGBs of the UK, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think basically it was, you know, Roger Eagle was a great guy, and he'd been...
He was like a Guy Stevens character.
He was a Northern Soul DJ in Manchester in quite a famous Northern Soul club called the Twisted Wheel, and he had a fabulous record collection, and he'd somehow ended up in Liverpool, you know, in this club, and decided he was going to be based there, and he was just you know, he was a real music fan, you know, a real music fan. I remember he used to go into his office and there would just be thousands and thousands of records. And at the time, it's a really treasured memory for me because I was just some kid who was kind of knocking about that street, and it was his treasured record collection. And he used to let me go in, and I'd go in every week, and he'd give me three records he felt everyone should know, but nobody did. And he'd give me three albums, and I'd return the three he'd given me, and I'd have them at home for a week, you know, and then I could come back in and swap them. I really did discover a lot of music that way, you know, and he would tell me which ones to listen to, and it might be, you know, an old Benny King album, or it might be, you know, it could be anything.
And
it really widened my, you know, my musical kind of landscape. But at the same time, he was putting on all these punk bands and very into that whole vital energy and young bands.
I remember when he died, Bill Drummond wrote a classic Bill type piece, like a eulogy piece, but talking about what should be done. And he talked about Roger's record collection. He was saying it is this great national monument. What should be done with it? Obviously, being Bill, he said it should be encased in concrete and turned into a sort of obelisk.
At least he didn't want to burn it, you know.
Yeah.
There was this famous group as well called the Crucial Three, which was Julian Cope and Pete Wiley and Ian McCulloch. Did you ever go
showing the shyness and self-effacing reticence that they would go on to be known for?
But did you ever see that band?
I don't think they ever played, to be honest. Even though you might say they did,
it was a bedroom.
You know, there was many a discussion, you know, there are a lot of bands.
Yeah, manifestos, lots of manifestos.
Yeah, and I think there are a lot of bands, and it seemed like, you know, you just came up with a great name and then you all go around for a month saying you were in that band. I think they did actually try and write a couple of songs somewhere, but I don't think they ever kind of particularly, I'm not sure they ever played.
And after Big in Japan, you sort of, you had Original Mirrors. I mean, with Steve Allen was from Deaf School, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who I worked with a lot. I went on to work with Perils of Plastic. And in fact, well, I want to think about Original Mirrors, because I used to go and see Original Mirrors a lot.
Okay.
Partly because I thought you were great. And also because Pete Townsend was an avowed great fan. I remember he used to wear an Original Mirrors T-shirt. And I used to go and see Original Mirrors in the hope that he'd be there.
Yeah, it was quite an amazing thing for me, that, because I remember, you know, obviously I'd sort of come to that London, basically on the advice of the guitar player from The Only Ones. And I was living in a kind of a squat in Kilburn, and I ended up in the band with Steve, who's probably the only person.
Phil Spalding. I think that was.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The great Phil Spalding.
And it was, I think we played the Marquee, and all of a sudden this guy came in the dressing room, give me a big hug, you know, your guitar, you know, and I'm like, is this Pete Townsend? You know, what's going on? Is this Pete Townsend? You know, and then he used to just come to a lot of the gigs and was very supportive, great, you know, and I was a little overwhelmed, you know, by that, to be honest, you know.
Because you know what? I've got to say one thing about Original. Sorry, Gary.
No.
One thing about Original Mirrors is that I've been listening to. I found some great old clips on YouTube and stuff. Oh. And do you know what? There was one track I listened to. I can't remember which one it's called, but it was like, "Oh my God, it's Duran Duran! You invented Duran Duran! It's literally that exact sound, the rhythm section, everything. It's you literally invented Duran Duran."
I think it has elements of Simple Minds. It's where U2 were going to go. It was really at the head of the curve, wasn't it?
I think I seem to remember that I bought a space echo, basically. Do you know what I mean? And I don't think many people had them. And I
Andy
loved
Summers did.
That would be echo. And basically, you know, so there was a lot of that going on. And it was a very powerful rhythm section. It was like, as you say, and a guy called Pete Kircher, who had been in a lot of 60s bands, was a bit older than us. But like an amazingly powerful drummer, you know.
Older drummers seem to be a bit of a trademark with you.
I always go like that, don't I, when I say drummer. You know, I don't know why I always have to do the thing.
But just to carry on with the Pete Townsend thing while he's in our little story world, is you actually ended up doing, was it, I don't know, Tilt or one of your later Lightning Seeds albums? Down at Il Pie Island on his barge, didn't you? Was Pete around then? Did he suddenly go, "You're the kid"?
Well, no. What happened was he'd asked me to produce an album, actually, and I was always he asked me
of his,
yeah.
Wow.
And I was always, you know, reticent to do it because it's Pete Townsend. I was like, I can't tell Pete Townsend to change that bit, you know. Or, yeah, it's Pete Townsend telling him that, you know. And then it had been sort of on the for a few years, and then we decided that what we'd do would be we had a kind of a meeting, and I love the actually thinking back now, it's kind of a funny thing to say, but I love the Who before it becomes ultra manly. I like it after that as well, but I really love the 60s singles and just the whole
vulnerable
thing.
Yeah.
And the footage of him in his demo place doing all the stuff. And I was like, you know, I love all that. I'd love to do something. Would you be up for doing something like that? So he was kind of all about, right, I'm going to just play Rickenbacker and we'll get the whole thing. And he had his barge. So I think he just, maybe to be a bit like that demo studio and stuff, he said, right, let's just deck it out and make that the place that we record. So we put everything on board and stuff. And then before we were about to start, he fell off his bicycle. I got a call from his assistant saying, oh, Pete's fallen and broken two fingers. But he wants to go ahead and have someone else play guitar. And I was like, we can't do that, really. We can't can't do a solo album with that idea of someone else playing guitar. So it kind of just ended up on the back burner or gone. And then because I've been setting up the barge and everything, I remember saying, you know, I love this space, you know. And he said, well, why don't I lease it to you for 10 years? So it kind of became my studio for 10 years, which was lovely. So I had this lovely...
Was that the big barge?
It was an ocean-going barge, yeah.
Yeah, no, I worked there with Gary Moore. It's amazing.
Yeah, they had to dismantle the engine in case someone got in and drove it. I think someone did get in and drive it off once.
So is that still decked out with your spec?
No, probably not, because that desk went. But it was, I mean, he'd sort of treated it. It was a great, well, as you know then, you know, it was a lovely place. The only drawback with it was that it was on the river. And I used to go down there to write late at night sometimes. And there was a gangplank going onto the river. And a spotlight would come on anytime anything moved. And this light would come on. And obviously, being by a river, there's lots of insects. So I started to go in there at night and the light would come on and the gangplank would literally be wall-to-wall spider, giant spiders in webs. And I used to get this and I used to say, I just can't get on. So I used to get this stick and try, and we literally have 2,000 spiders, like thousands of spiders. So it became a bit of an issue to me that I couldn't get on the boat because it was bedecked with spiders, you know. And then we took
a lot of acid at the time.
And it was like, I'm writing my album, I can't get on board.
They're all soft from Liverpool, aren't they?
Guy. We had to hire this guy. We didn't want to kill him or anything. So we hired this guy with a giant hose who came along the river and hosed the whole thing down. And all these people were watching in the day. Must have been 10,000 spiders came off the boat. You know, it was... Wow. I should have, you know, in those days, I didn't have my phone, but if you'd filmed it, you wouldn't have believed it, you know.
TikTok heaven.
I mean, we're still in, let's get back to that world still, because then you had another band called Care. There's a bunch of these bands, the Wild Swans, that all seem to be pouring out of Liverpool. Were you disappointed? How were you going from like Big in Japan to Original Mirrors and then to Care? Was it a bit like your dad going, son, just give it up now?
No, it was a strange situation because I was in the band with Bill and we started the label Zoo Records, and then Bill carried that on and signed Echo and the Bunnymen and Teardrop Explodes. And then the story is what happened was, so I was at a bus stop on a place called Smithtown Road in Liverpool. And the Bunnymen had just signed a record deal and stuff. And they were in their van. Les had bought a van, a rickety old van. And they went past the bus stop and stopped and said, "Ian, you know, like, jump in, we'll give you a lift to Penny Lane, you know." So we were in there, and there was the tape on a cassette. And I was, you know, "What's this? You know, this sounds good." And they're like, "Oh, it's us. We've just been to this place called Rockfield, but we're not happy with the recording." And me being me was like, "Well, that's because you're doing that right, and that should be there. And, you know, you this, that, and the other, you know." And then didn't think much of it. And they dropped me off at where I lived, you know, and went on. And then I got this call from Bill a few days later saying, "Oh, you know, the Bunnymen were saying you had some great ideas about the songs. Do you fancy producing them, you know?" And I was like, "Well, you know, I've never produced anything. And that sounds a bit businessman-y. I'm not sure, you know, I'm a songwriter." And he was like, "You know, I think it'd be great if you would do it." And I was like, "Nah, it sounds like crossing a line." So I initially said no. And then it being Liverpool at that time and Bill being Bill, he phoned me back and he said, "What about if you didn't produce them, but you had an alter ego and he produced them?" And I was like, "Well, who is this alter ego?" And they said, "Well," he said, "Well, do you have an alter ego?" And I said, "Well, there has been this character called Kingbird, who I've often, you know, dreamt of being." And so he said, "Well,
that's handy.
Kingbird can produce them." And I was like, "You're right, you know." So actually the Bunnymen records that I produce say, you know, a Kingbird production. They don't have my name on. But that sort of set me off into this world of being a producer, really. I ended up, you know, producing a couple of things for them.
What do you call producing? What do you think it is, and what is it for you?
Well, what it was then and what it is now are two very different things. It felt like, so for me, producing Echo and the Bunnymen was, they were my mates. And I just joined the band for that period of time, played guitar, wrote, you know, did whatever you did. If you were in a band, that's how I saw it. But I kind of knew about microphones and all that. So it was like we could record it. And sometimes I'd be in that room and there was no, so that really wasn't production. That was kind of, you know, there was no barriers at all. It was a
But is that something that just came to you? I mean, from when you first got your guitar, you first started writing, you just always had this big picture of kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, I think so. And I don't really know how I knew about recording a microphone. I don't really know how I remember, you know, but yeah, I don't know. I just seemed to be able to do it quite instinctively. But I was always very unwilling. It was always a little bit... I think it carried on that theme of me not wanting to be pulled into being a producer, really. I wanted to be a songwriter. But that kind of deflected me for about 10 years, probably, where I just was working with other people but not writing my own songs.
Just talking about the sound of that band, and then there was obviously, you know, Wah and with Pete Wiley and Teardrop Explodes. It was a very different sound to anything else coming out of the UK. It seemed to have a kind of, I mean, the sort of, it had more in common, I think, with American groups like Television and that sort of intellectual art punk and Talking Heads. But it was also this amazing euphoria, energy, and that didn't seem to be anywhere else. But the Echo and the Bunnymen, I think, did have a sort of darkness, a kind of Doors sound about them. Why was that so? Was that very Liverpool? What was going on? Was it Eric?
Well, I know, speaking for myself personally, I was far more into the American in that era of punk. The bands I loved were the Ramones, Talking Heads, Television, Patti Smith, you know. And I could really, to be honest, take or leave the Clash and etc. I liked them. I used to go and see them. But the things that really fascinated me were, you know, were probably those New York, from the New York Dolls and Iggy Pop. I loved all that. And Lou Reed, I suppose. I was a massive Velvet Underground fan as a kid. That was the band that I loved, was the Velvet Underground. So it led me into the whole New York thing. And I think, you know, I've got this theory that no one else agrees with, which I'm going to now say. But in Liverpool, at the time, there was a Woolworths on Allerton Road and maybe in town as well. And in this Woolworths, for some reason, they had this section called deletions of records. And all the records had the corners cut off them. And it was just certain records. And they were basically 60p, 70, or probably
Why
less
did they
than
cut 30, the corners off?
No, so that you knew that it wasn't a proper album or something, you know. So it was old stock.
It was like your passport, like your old
passport.
Yeah,
when it's no longer valid, you know. Don't be fooled, you know. These are to be thrown away, maybe. Yeah. And so there was this specific load of records that were obviously left over from something. And it was basically Love, The Doors, Faust for some reason, a lot of kraut rock kind of thing. And it was all these things, and you could buy them, you know, for literally so much less than a normal album. And so, and Captain Beefheart as well. Yeah. A lot of Captain Beefheart albums. So I think
Frank
a lot
Zappa.
Of people at the time, we used to buy them because when you're a kid, you just were looking for new music. There wasn't Spotify then or anything. So, you know, I would have just listened to anything that I'd never heard before that had a good cover. You basically looked at the cover, thought, that's one for me, you know. Mm-hmm. So I remember buying Love and then really liking it and buying another. There were about three Love albums in there. And there was things from Track Records, which would be, one side would be The Who and one side
would be Jimi Hendrix. Oh, yeah, those samplers. Yeah.
And, you know, stuff like that. So very eclectic stuff. So for me, that's why I, you know, and Scott Walks, you know, so those things were in that shop and I used to buy them and listen to them over and over again. And I think maybe if that was like that for me, maybe that was a bit of a thing in Liverpool that...
Because what's extraordinary is you're talking about an incredibly cool niche record shop, but it's actually the deletion section of Woolworths.
It's Woolworths. And funny enough, I read a book, you know, recently called Howling at the Moon, and it was about a guy who ran.
Oh, what's his name? CBS, Walter Yetnikoff.
Yeah. And in it, it says that him and the guy from Elektra Records had this scam going where they would divert a load of records to a warehouse they owned and then flog them themselves with the corners cut off around the world outside the US. So it must have been, and I was like, wow, that's the records I used to buy in Woolworths, you know. So somehow they ended up from there in Woolworths on Elton Road in Liverpool.
One more question.
And shaped a generation.
One more question about Liverpool. Was there a sense of responsibility about being a musician in Liverpool that was greater, do you think, than anywhere else, given its history with the Beatles?
It's one of those strange things where the Beatles had just been, to a degree, because you're talking like now.
Well, not when you're young, because to you kids, it's kind of ancient history, isn't it?
Well, growing up and I was, you know, seven, the Beatles were, you know, Liverpool, and it was all happening. And I adored the Beatles, you know, the first albums I got. And I always adored the Beatles. But it was almost like if you said that, you couldn't be in the group anymore. Do you know what I mean? It was like, no, that's old Liverpool and we're the next generation, you know. But it's quite strange because so things like that we were listening to, like The Doors and Love, felt like they were 100 years before. But actually, they were probably 8 years before, you know, because you're talking it's 1975, 1976, and they were probably around in 1968. So, but it felt like a whole, you know, something that, you know, no one had ever heard of, and you discovered this guy, this band called The Doors, who probably no one had ever heard of in the world other than you. Obviously, that wasn't the case because they were a massive band. But at that time, I had no idea who they were, you know. And I think, you know, the same, you know, with the Velvets and all that. And I think there was just a gathering of people who were a little bit misfits, really, all in Matthew Street around that time in Eric's, just at the moment when punk rock was happening. So you'd get, you know, the bands had come over from Manchester to play on a Thursday night, and it would be the Buzzcocks and the Fall and all these things that you were scratching your head about. What is this? You know, it's great, like, but what is it? You know, and so you were getting a very eclectic mix of
magazine.
Magazine.
What was the thing between Liverpool and Manchester? Was it sort of competitive, or was it?
I don't think it was. I used to, you know, produce records for Factory, and Tony Wilson'd be in Liverpool, and there was Zoo and there was Factory. OMD, I think, you know, did the record on Factory, not on Zoo. Because Bill probably didn't understand what a synth was at that time or something. And, you know, early on, Big in Japan, Joy Division, you know, that we'd all be playing the same little venues, Rafters in Manchester or wherever it'd be. Yeah. So it felt very connected. It felt more like, I'm sure you felt the same at that time. It felt more like anyone who got the Ramones and got that whole thing was part of your gang. It wasn't geographical. They were people you could get on with.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, or you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock On Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
We can't get onto the lightning seeds before we talk about you producing Marky Smith and The Fall. I mean, I can't think of anything more terrifying. Could you, guys? I mean, did you ever meet?
Do you know? No, the one encounter I had with him was I went to Manchester. I had to get the train and I was meeting someone at the station, and they said, sorry, I'm going to be late. There was that pub right next to Manchester Piccadilly, right? There's that pub just there. I thought, I'll just go and sit in the pub. And I went into the pub and Marky Smith came and sat at the next table. And I just thought, you're having a laugh, aren't you? This is just Manchester.
Manchester.
Yeah.
How was it?
I got on great with Mark, actually. I really liked Mark, you know, and at that time, actually, I was just at the point where I was sort of, right, if I don't do my own songs now, I'm going to end up being a producer, and I don't want to be a producer, you know, I like the whole idea of producers particularly. And, you know, and then I ended up with The Fall, and we were chatting about it, and he was like, I had a couple of songs, makes me cringe now a little bit, that I'd written, and I ended up kind of playing them. And he was like, amazingly supportive, you know, and you've got to do this, and really encouraging. And he used to, but he wanted me to call it, I decided to call it Lightning Seeds, but he was like, no, you've got to call it The Hordes of Brood. And he used to send me letters with, and he'd draw The Hordes of Brood with bows and arrows and stuff. And he was lovely, you know, and he was, to be fair, I don't know if I'd have had the confidence to actually make, you know, to record my own songs without his
was
so encouraging, you know. To be honest, and at the time, probably Ian McNabb as well, they were just very, very, you know, encouraging and kind of, you know, so it was quite,
Ian McNabb had High School Works, right? They had a couple of big hits. But did he not play Mind Games at all in the studio?
No, I mean, I thought it was hilarious. He was just, you know, he was a total eccentric, and he could be, you know, I'm sure he could be the devil, or he could be, you know, but I just remember laughing loads. And, you know, there's one Marky Smith story that we'd recorded an album and we'd mixed it, and we were going to the townhouse to master it. And, we were mastering with a guy called Ian, I think. So we sat there and we had this, I think it was probably the 2-inch or the 1/4-inch, and it was all sounding great. And Mark arrived, and he'd always arrived, he'd have his Leo's, which was a supermarket in Manchester with beers in it, cans of bitter, you know. So, you know, he sort of arrived, cracked open a beer, and we played it. And yeah, I remember him saying, yeah, that sounds all right. You know, that sounds all right. But I was at home, and I got the cassette you gave me, and I played it through this, and it sounded great. So could you put a mic on this and make that the record? And I was like, oh, you know. And you sure, you know, that's, I'm sure he knew it was just, you know. And I was like, well, you know, and he was like, well, you know, can you do that, you know?
The challenge is him saying, tell me why.
Exactly. And I was getting ready this whole speech of why that's not a great idea, and you know, and it's so obvious that it's hard to explain. And before I could say anything, the mastering engineer Ian said, just a second, hold on. And he left the room, and he came back with a massive knife, like a massive bread knife type thing. And he kind of walked past Mark, and he showed him the knife and put the knife on there, and he said, I think we'll just do what we were doing. We just mastered it and left the room. And Mark said to me, he's great, that guy.
Did you say it was a great thing in Viz, I think last month or the month before, which was Fall Lawyers for You, like, have you been injured at work? It was, most people in Britain have been a member of the Fall at some point. Were you unfairly dismissed by Mark and Smith? It could be money waiting.
he just tested you, you know, and but it was funny. And then when he left and he was like, he's great, that guy. And it was, we were both laughing, you know, and it was, it, you know, you'd always be laughing at the end.
Ian, where did Pure come from? And not just how did it happen, but why were you writing a song like that, given this kind of background of music that we're talking about?
I think, you know, when you write it, I'm sure if you, you know, you have this idea about what you'd like to do, and then something comes out that's not in what you were trying to do. You know, you do what you do, I suppose, you know. And, you know, I was writing a few songs, and I interestingly, Pure was the first song that I really wrote a lyric to myself, and I'd written it, and I felt, when I went to record it, I was recording it, and I thought, I've blown it, you know, because you usually see a lyric sheet written out, and this had tons and tons of words. It was like lion smiling the dog, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, this is not how a song should look. So I sang it, and then I thought, it is way too many words. And I remember saying, so I never mixed it, and I never top and tail the front and the end. I remember saying to the engineer, I'm scrapping this one. Don't, you know, this is too. And he was like, I think this is a great one. I was like, I'm giving, you know, it's too, it's like I'm just talking, you know what I mean? It's too personal, I think. You know, it should be simpler. So he said, well, let me just put it down. So he put it down onto the DAT. And then later, when I sort of sent off, there was basically a guy, and I'd been producing a band called The Pale Fountains.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And this guy who was a publisher, and he was a 60s guy with a big cigar and a rogue, a lovable rogue.
Who was it? And who?
A guy called Dick Leahy.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
And he'd said to me, if you've ever got any, you know, he'd said to me, you're obviously, you know, like, good, you're making this band sound a lot better than they would. You know, if you've never got a song yourself, you know, send me your songs, you know. So I sent this DAT or this a cassette of, I copied it and I sent it to him. And I really didn't have any idea how to go about, you know, getting a record contract or anything, because I didn't have a group, you know. So at that time, everyone in Liverpool, like the record companies were coming to Liverpool, seeing a band, signing them for loads of money, whether it was, you know, there was the Lars, the Real People, the, you know, just all these bands were signing these deals, you know. And I was like, well, I don't really have a band. And I'm just recording this, you know, like recorded it mainly at home and a little bit in the studio to see the singing when they gave me some free time in the studio in Kirby in Liverpool. So, you know, I didn't really know what to do it. So I sent in these songs, and that was on the front of it, but I hadn't realised. And then he sort of gave me this phone call. I remember it, you know, he phoned up and he said, I'm sitting in my garden. I've got a lovely chilled glass of rosé and I'm listening to the song. You know, and I was like, which song? And he was like, Pure. What, you know, it's great. Let's put it out, you know. And I was like, well, we'll have to go and get a record contract. And he said, we'll have 500 pressed up and I'll hire a plugger. So I was like, okay, you know, so that's what he did really. So, and I was like, well, that's not really, you know, I haven't really finished that one. He was like, no, it's perfect, you know. And I was like, well, you know, it's got all this bit where I'm getting in time at the beginning, going bum, bum, to get in time for when it starts. And he's like, no, that's part of the charm, you know. So, and he was dead right, really. So he had 500 pressed up. And we put it, Rough Trade Shop, put them out a bit. And it kind of just hung around for months and months, you know, and it was... They'd phone me up every few weeks to say, oh, it's number 167 in the charts. And then it's gone up to 152. And
was it getting radio play?
180. Was getting, well, it wasn't really. And then John Peel played it. And then we'd hear like a bloke in Stoke was playing it all the time. And someone on a local radio on the evening. And it just gradually started to kind of perk. And it was out for ages. And then... It eventually, it just I think it was Steve Wright who was in the afternoon show. And apparently, I don't know, the plugger had got him to play it, which was, you know, kind of weird.
Who was the plugger? Do you remember?
Yeah, I was going to say.
A guy called Scott Peering.
Scott Peering.
He was a legend.
He was a legend.
He was a great guy.
Yeah.
And and Steve Wright played it, and they'd said to me, you know, he's gonna play your record on the radio, you know, and all that, you know. So I was listening, you know, and I got halfway through and he took it off. I thought, oh no, you know, he thinks it's not up to standard, you know. And he said, I'm just saying, who is this, you know? I'm gonna play it again from the beginning. This is great. And he played it, and then he said, I'm gonna play it again. He played it again, you know, which was kind of unheard of. And that was the moment it just sort of,
right,
you know, the people at the radio went, oh, we better put this on the list and all. So then promptly, I think we'd done a video in my back garden or something, you know, and they put the video on Top of the Pops. It ran out of records completely because there were only about, you know, 1,000 of them in existence. And then it just, I don't know, it just carried on from there, really, and it started to get play in America.
Rodney Bingenheimer rang you, didn't he?
That was the thing. So I was sort of in Liverpool. The phone went, you know, and this guy said, is this the Lightning Seeds? You know, I was like, well, it's Ian, you know. And he said, I'm in LA. My name's Rodney Bigger. I'm playing your record on K-Rock. You're the number one most requested record in California. And I was like, who is
this? Is that Rodney Bingenheimer as in Rodney's English Disco?
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
I think he was kind of mates with Mark. He was a bit of a legendary character.
That's right, yeah. It's where Bowie and everyone used to hang out. Yeah. And Iggy, yeah.
He was like, you know...
He's still around.
Okay. And I said to him, who is this? My record's not even out in America, so I know it's bullshit. You know what I mean? And he was like, no, I was in Portobello Market, heard it, brought it back to America, played it, and then the other stations started importing it, and now it's most requested because no one can buy it.
Because K-Rock was a massive station. It broke our band. It broke Duran Duran. This is all out of with a guy called Richard Blade out of LA.
And you know, from there, I think it went on to MTV, and then it started to sort of be around America and stuff. So it was like, it was a bit like a fairy, you know. I mean, it was like a bit of a mirror. I mean, I was totally unprepared. I didn't have a group. I'd never sung in public.
But you have this great production career behind you already. That's extraordinary about this.
Yeah.
You
know? As long as they didn't need a gig, I was fine, yeah.
So then you have to put a band together, right?
Well, I didn't actually. We didn't actually play until the third album. I remember them phoning up and I remember this silence. I think I was on a call where they've got you on the speaker in a meeting room, and they signed me to MCA in America. And they said, great, you know, we need to get the band out here on tour, you know. And I said, oh, you know, there isn't a band, you know, it's just me. And they said, okay, we can put a band together. And I said, oh, I don't really sing in public. And there was just silence, do you know what I mean? And I genuinely thought, I'd never thought it through, really. I'd never really thought, you know, I'd only ever sung in the studio, you know. So it was very daunting to me. So I didn't actually do that until Jollification, which was probably about 4 years later.
So, but when would I have met you? Because I met you at Le Parc Hotel, and it would have been Riley, wouldn't it? Who inspired the life of Riley. It would have been Riley swimming in the pool with my son Finn.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So I'm guessing Riley's in his early 30s now, right?
Yeah.
So what was that? Was that the first tour you did out there?
It wasn't a tour. So because I didn't play live, and I think the second album was out, and it was, I think the singles Sense and Life for Riley were on college radio and all that. So they brought me out for a radio promo tour. So I used to just go and do interviews, and they'd put me in Le Parc, and then they'd fly me out to various places, you know,
right.
to do interviews, yeah. So I was, and I still wasn't playing live then, really, you know.
And then you get the match of the day thing with Life of Riley, right?
Yeah, which was...
Is that kind of what made you put the sort of football music thing on your radar? I don't know. It's just,
yeah, I don't know. Really, stupid. Because that was completely random, you know. Yeah. That was so random because obviously it's a song about waiting for him to be bored and worrying about it, you know. So it was, couldn't have been further away. But then it did seem to really fit with the football, you know. So I suppose that was a little hint that one day, you know, football would be a...
Listen, I love Jollification. When it came out, I played it so much. I just thought it was... I've read that you don't like this phrase, but I thought it was perfect pop. And perfect is the first track on the album. I mean, I think Lucky You is still one of the greatest pop records of all time. I mean, seriously.
From you, that is proper great.
Seriously. And what I didn't realise at the time is that you co-wrote that with Terry Hall from The Specials.
Yeah, absolutely.
How did that come about?
Well, I suppose we were...
Had you stayed in touch the whole time since...
No, not really. I remember meeting him then, and then I kind of bumped into him. I think he was a fan of the Bunnymen. And we were at a festival that Peter Gabriel had called WOMAD, and the Bunnymen were playing with the Burundi drummers. And I remember I was standing on the side of the stage with Terry and we were chatting. And then I think Pete, who was the drummer in the Bunnymen.
De Freitas.
Pete De Freitas. He played on a Colourfield album. So Terry was in Liverpool. And we all used to have a football game that we played in Sefton Park. And I remember Terry coming to the football game and us playing football. And I think that was the start of our friendship. And then he sort of said, would you fancy producing a couple of tracks? And kind of went from there. And then, I remember we decided we'd try and write a song. I was going to do the second album. And we wrote a song called Sense. And I think he thought he was writing it so he could record it. And I thought I was writing it so I could record it. We never really discussed it.
How did you write together? Did you say, I've got these chords and he comes up with the top line and the melody or the lyrics?
Yeah, something like that, really. Yeah, I had to pause the studio and he came up to Liverpool and we hung out and then he took a little Porter studio version of it home with humming and stuff. And then he put, you know, some words to it. And then I was recording the album in the front. I wasn't recording in the studio then still. I was just recording at home. So I had a sort of, actually my brother had a house and I had all my stuff in his front room because he wasn't using that room. So then Terry came to that room and we, you know, went through the lyrics and sung it that day. And that was the record kind of thing.
On this album, making Jollification, did you feel this is it? This is what the Lightning Seeds I've been aiming for all this time. Because it was an incredible record.
It was a funny situation. So I got dropped by MCA. Rough Trade had gone bankrupt, you know, so I didn't really have a record contract, but I'd moved my stuff out the house and had a studio in the centre of Liverpool. And I was kind of becoming a producer, but I had my songs. So I decided just to record it. So I'd recorded pretty much most of the record, but I didn't have a record contract. I wasn't sure it would come out. And it had been... So I still didn't have a band and I hadn't played live. But what was great was the technology had moved on. And although you didn't have Logic or any of the computers and stuff, I had an S900 and I could sample. And I'd heard De La Soul and the hip hop records. And I thought, well, maybe I could adapt the way they record and use loops. So myself and a guy called Simon Rogers, and we'd get records and record loops into it. So There's no drums really on that. It's all kind of loops and stuff we took off records because I didn't have a band, you know. So we kind of got halfway through doing it and I was producing a track for Alison Moyet, actually. Oh. And her A&R person came up to hear some bits. And then we were chatting afterwards and we got on really well. And he was saying, yeah, I love the Lightning Seeds. What happened to that? You know? And I was like, oh, you know, I don't have a record contract. You know, I am recording some tunes, you know? And he said, can I hear them? You know? So I played him the songs and he was like, I just want to sign this. And so I just basically ended up, he said, you know, sign to us and finish the record. We'll put it out. We've got to promise you'll do some gigs. And I was like, yeah, no, I'm up for doing gigs. So that was the bargain was, you know, you'll play live.
Sorry, do you remember the first time you actually did get up and sing live?
Yeah, I was terrified. And it was kind of weird.
Because listen, you're getting on a bit to be singing live for the first time, aren't you, by the time you
thanks for that vote of confidence.
No, but I mean, you know, normally kids do it in their teenage years.
No, exactly. So you're rubbish at it and in a sense, you're growing up in public. So it is quite daunting, you know. It's the idea of, you know, monitors and what? This is, you know, this isn't like the studio at all.
Where was it?
So it was really daunting. We played a place called the Duke of York in is it York probably or the Duke of, it was somewhere like that, you know, and it was like a pub, and there was this guy, and I always remember I thought, well, we've never had a gig on sale, I wonder if anyone will come, and they put the gig on sale, and then he phoned up and he said the tickets are nearly all gone, it's been great, you know, and it was only a warm-up. I was like, okay. And then about 2 days before, the guy phoned up again. He said, sorry, I was looking in the wrong drawer. I've had a sold-out notice up for ages, and all the tickets are in the other drawer. So there's
no one coming.
Oh, great, thanks. So that was the start of my live career, was the tickets were in the wrong drawer. But we sold them all. yeah, it's like, this is great. This is live stuff. And we did a gig. And then we drove to London and we played the place off Tottenham Court Road, whatever it was called.
Astoria?
Break for the Border. No, not the...
The
Mexican...
The bookshop, Hit Heel, you know...
I know. What's it called? Damn. Legendary place. Yeah. Downstairs. Yeah.
It is Break. Yes. It is Break for the Border, but it's something like that, isn't it?
I can't remember what it's called, but...
Borderline!
That's it. Well done, yeah. Madonna, of course. So we played the Borderline. It was terrifying, you know. And then, you know, we were off and running. But I thought, you know, I don't think I could bear to do more of this. It's terribly frightening. And Terry actually funny said, why don't we just do some gigs together and you'll see your mate singing? And we'll just segue it all into one. And so we sort of had a band that played with both of us, and I did a few tunes, and then he came on. We sort of just made the whole thing into one thing. We did three gigs like that, and that gave me a bit more confidence to be on stage. So that kind of, I think it was great of him to do that, actually.
Have you produced the specials?
That's very generous, Terry. Isn't
it? Very lovely of him. No, but I produced Terry's solo album. We've written a fair bit together, and you know, we've stayed friends.
Can you be produced? Or do you respond very badly?
That's a bit weird to ask other people about that.
Ask his mother.
I'm not. I'd say, well, actually, on my new album, it's quite lovely actually, because I hadn't done an album for 14, 15 years. And I wasn't sure I wanted to do one. And I was quite enjoying just the romantic idea of the troubadour, you know, just playing live, not worrying about recording, enjoying, you know, complete reversal of previously where I was daunted by, because I really like it now and I really like singing. And so,
because Tell's told you're going in that sort of direction, aren't you?
Yeah, and just a bit
a lovely
more.
Record, by the way.
See you in the stars. Yes, very nice album. We got sent it. Thank you. Yeah.
I'd produced a band when sort of Lightning Seeds went on pause, because we had Tilt, which was a massive flop, and it felt like, oh, that's probably that would stop for a while, and what will I do? I sort of started working. I kind of reverted, I suppose, to being a producer, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and I started working with a couple of unsigned bands from Liverpool, who my mate Nathan had played me a tape of this band, and I thought they're really good, you know. So I kind of got in touch, and one of those bands was called The Coral, and then I later produced their first three albums or whatever, and then they've grown up now, and James is a producer, and James was like, you know, you need to do a record, just come up to Liverpool, I'm in the studio here, I'll produce you. And my first thought was, as you just said, am I producible? You know, I don't know if I'm producible, you know. But I suppose the people who've remained very close to who I've produced would be Terry, the Bunny Men, and the Coral, really. And I feel like it's almost like family. So I went up, and James produced a track. You know, we just spent 2 days, and it's a track called It's Great to Be Alive, which I'd sort of written, but I wasn't sure. You know, when it's an abstract idea that you might do some more recording, you know, you're like, but then once you make a track and you think, well, I like this, you know, I'd like someone to hear this, and you start getting a couple more, then it starts to become a reality, and you think, I've got these songs that I actually like, and I'd like to release something, and then everything grows from there.
And you wrote another track with Terry, didn't you?
Yeah, so then I wrote a track called Emily Smiles with Terry, and so it was kind of my friends got me back up to speed in a way, you know, which is great. And Riley is my manager and plays guitar with me.
That's
now.
Amazing.
So it's become a friend and family affair.
What's incredible about you is that you listen to all of your records. Your voice has never changed. You know, yeah, you're still... we're all secretly now. I think all three of us are secretly in our 60s now. But you listen to your voice and you're still that young kid who sang pure. I can't hear any difference. You've got a vitality and a youthfulness that still comes across on the record.
Thanks. I maybe that comes from not, you know, I'm not a singer. I think there's people who are singers, and when they're growing up, they imagine themselves as, you know, David Bowie, you know, and I think I imagine myself as Mick Ronson always. I never imagined myself as Dave. I was always
Side
Mick. Man. Yeah. And then I've ended up singing. So I think maybe it's something to do with that. You know, it's like you're always making up for that. So you're always trying to, I always feel like, you know, you have to have a great melody if you're not a great singer. But if you've got a great melody, you can't go far wrong. And then that takes you back into trying to be completely positive without being banal. And I think it's quite difficult to make positive up records without being banal. And I don't have a problem with perfect pop. I just think I would hate perfection, and my records are all happy accidents, but I am a bit obsessive, and I definitely think the pursuit of excellence is something I would begin.
I was watching Jay-Z.
So like you're pitching to produce our album.
Yes, absolutely. I was watching Jay-Z last night being interviewed, and Jay-Z said, you know, I think to be a proper successful star, you have to have 3 decades of successful music. And you qualify because you know, the 80s, you're making, producing hit records. You know, the 90s, you're making hit records. Then you're back in production. I mean, we're passing over the Corals and the Zootons, but I mean, both of them platinum records. But you're back now doing what you want to do on your own. Are you going to go and play live?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I've continued playing live, and I've got a lovely band around me. It's taken all this time. I've got a lovely band around me. I love playing the gigs. The whole thing is my favorite bit now, really, to be honest, because I think what I loved about recording, you know, when I was a producer and I had my studio, I loved the camaraderie of the whole, you know, you're getting in the morning, it'd be a bit cold, get the tea on, everyone would arrive, you chatted, you know, then you all start doing the drummer thing again, then we'll start playing. And I love that sociability of musicians. I love all that. And it's become a bit more of a solitary computer operator kind of situation, you know, and doing the last album, I did it a lot like that. A lot of it was, I've always recorded at home, but I used to always have people around, you know? So I think I drifted into that, and I'm only going to work in company, if you know what I mean. I think there's a slightly lost art when you're talking about production and going through decades and stuff like that. I used to know when to go, that's the take. And now I was trying to do that, you know, during this, and it's like, well, that's not the take, but it can be, because we can do all this and we might do that. And, you know,
you have to commit to anything. Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like I really miss the commitment and the thing of being with other people and creating a moment. And my favorite bit about recording was that moment when you got it, and it would probably be over just a few days, and it's coming through the speakers and you've mixed it, and it's something that didn't exist and now does exist and is something, and you can't change it, you know. And now everything's completely changeable all the time. and all records are made like that. And I miss, and I think I hear it when I hear things now, you know, and so I really would like to make some records that are a lot of people in a room creating something for that moment.
Yeah, I think, you know, I get it entirely. You know, I sit here and I make music on my own. I can't get around to singing on my own. I don't know whether it's good or bad. You know, I always want to get someone in for that. But there's nothing that beats the tour that I'm on with at the moment with Guy. You know, we've been touring all year. That band camaraderie, the humour, the fun we have, Guy, is true.
It's why you do it in the first place. Yeah. And I feel like a lot of the time, this might be a bit technical, I don't know if it's but I feel like I'm in front of a computer screen going, that's almost like the real thing. That's almost like the real thing. Yes, that's almost like the real thing.
Yeah. Like, I think you too wrote that, didn't they?
Yeah. You know, and I think, well, you know, the real thing's over there. Why don't I just pick it up, you know, or you know, and, you know, so anyway, just for self-gratification, I think that's my ambition now, the next couple of years, is to make some more records, but in company and with an ensemble and capturing those moments, you know.
Brilliant.
When's the record coming out?
About 4 weeks' time, I think. Yeah, something like that.
You've got that really tempting thing on Apple Music, haven't you, where there's like one or two tracks and then they're all greyed out. It's a funny thing, that, isn't it?
Is it on there like that? Yeah, that's right, okay. It's quite daunting having something, you know, just having something out in the world.
And where are the gigs? Where are you going?
Just basically November, we're just around the country, really. Liverpool, London, Manchester, all of Leeds, Sheffield, Oxford, all, you know, about 16 gigs. Because we haven't, obviously, haven't played new music for a long time. And that's a tricky thing at this point, isn't it? Because everyone wants to hear the hits. And obviously, I will play all the hits. So you end up probably playing two or three new ones and varying them every night.
Well, thanks for, like, revealing some of the ghosts.
And, mate, 0 years of hurt.
Well, kind of, yeah. Till the next one.
Yeah. Well, it's this Christmas, isn't it? It'll be back.
Well, it was fantastic, actually, the Lionesses. It was just such a beautiful thing, and just the way they...
Girls show us how it's done.
It was just great, and just the way, you know, just all the paraphernalia of wasn't there, you know.
It was just wonderful, the kind of... the lack of taking themselves seriously and the inclusivity of... There's such great...
Is Vindaloo coming?
It's the only time that you can do a Christmas football record, isn't it? This is probably the only time ever that you can do that.
Vindaloo's not coming out again, is it, Guy?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't know.
Thank you so much for coming on.
That's been lovely chatting. Thank you.
Really great talking to you. Really, really lovely, man. Thank you. This is our kind of first... We're back after our first big break. So it's a really lovely place to start. So thank you.
Okay, well, it was very easy chatting to you. So thank you very much.
Ian, good luck with the album.
Thanks very much, mate.
Really lovely.
And anytime you fancy a cup of tea, that'd be lovely. Yeah.
That was a lovely season opener.
Nice to be back again.
Because I've got to say, I was nervous because it's just been so long since we've done it.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen you for so long, Gary. It was like having to get you to know you again.
Did you take a... You took a long time in front of the mirror this morning preparing yourself. Getting the
sort of days. It's just been three days.
Touch ups and stuff. Zoom filters. Varying ones.
Therapy.
So nice to be back. I hope that was a good season opener. And we will... We're recording actually this week, aren't we? We're doing a few, to be honest.
We're trying to get them in before we head stateside. So, yeah.
We've got some great, great ones coming up.
I'm
very excited about. So until then, it's good night for me.
And it's good night from everyone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.